Just a one-word addendum to what I tried to say last week about faith. The basic reason for believing, I think, is because I believe it's true. And all these other things are important, blah, blah, blah. They fit my experience. They illuminate things. But basically, it comes down to, is this true or not? So it's on that basis, I think, we have to make our decisions. Okay. So the readings today are clearly structured so that you get the bookends of the story of this Naaman, the Syrian general, and these 10 pagans. It helps to know a little bit about the geography of Palestine. Galilee was up north. That is the Lake of Galilee, good farming country. And then between Galilee and Judea, where Jerusalem was, there's a whole band called Samaria, which was not Orthodox Jewish. They had their own temple, which was anathema to Orthodox Jews, and they had their own priesthood, etc., etc., etc. They were kind of, in the view of everybody else, pseudo-Jews. And you had, if you wanted to go from Galilee to Jerusalem, you had to go through Samaria. That's why we get the story of the Good Samaritan in another context. So what the writers are getting at is a kind of wild invalidation of all a central point of Judaism. Namely, the Jews saw themselves as the chosen people. But instead of seeing themselves as chosen in order to be God's mission to the whole world, it turned, as not surprisingly it would, to a kind of self-aggrandizement. You know, I deserve to be chosen. I'm special. I'm chosen. It's like priests. You know, I'm special. I'm chosen. Well, it's rubbish for the priesthood, and it's rubbish for these Jews, too. So we got this pagan, this Syrian general. Then you got this Samaritan, another pagan or neo-pagan. And they're the people who are cured. Jesus, as a good Jew, would not have paid much attention. He would not eat with pagans. Of course, he would not associate with them as a Jew. But then, as in so much of his life, he was rebelling against a too narrow construct of what Judaism was supposed to be and what it was supposed to do. So here in this reading and in all kinds of other places in the New Testament, Jesus breaks open these boundaries that says we really are, as the scripture says over and over again, a light of revelation to the Gentiles. Everybody. And in preparing this, I two anecdotes in my past came to me, and I'm going to suggest that, although I'm older than everybody in this room, you may recognize the tendency here. When I was in grade school, St. Mary grade school, Sister Christella, this German neo-Hitlerian nun, said to us, you know, you even go into a Protestant church and it's mortal sin. You're hell-bent. So between St. Mary's school and my house, there was a Disciples of Church Christ, and we had to avert our eyes, you know, lest we be tempted to go inside their door and see what was going on there. And then even into university, and this to my undying shame, I'm invited by a good friend of mine to her brother's bar mitzvah in Chicago. So I was honored by the invitation and went with my then-time girlfriend. So I went onto the synagogue, totally unbidden. They stuck a yarmulke, a little skull cap on my head, draped a prayer shawl around my shoulders. And here I was, all equipped to participate in this neo-pagan ritual. So I was sitting there. Time went on, I got more and more agitated, nervous, until finally I tore off the skull cap and the prayer shawl and ran out of the synagogue rather than be polluted by all these non-Catholic things going on. I did that. I actually did that. And I said, to my undying shame, that happened a long, long time ago. I can't forget it. So it's another example of the official church retrenching on Jesus' words, Jesus' generosity. You know, again, you can compare the two most recent papacies. Cardinal Ratzinger and then the Pope, as Pope, wanted a smaller, purer church. So all the ne'er-do-wells could be shown the door and scooped out, because we didn't want that riffraff in polluting the truly holy ones. I don't know who we thought were the truly holy ones. Okay, but that was a constant theme of his papacy, a smaller, purer church. And he's still alive, of age, living in the Vatican, in some big apartment, in a convent. He just published another book of his last conversation, which I have yet to read. But I'm sure he had not changed his mind. And then comes Francis. Francis, whose best friend is the Jewish rabbi, back in Argentina. They wrote a book together. He's been at pains to wash the feet of not just Muslim men, but Muslim women on Holy Thursday. In other words, you get this almost unbelievable expansion of Catholic belief. What it means to be a Catholic, according to Francis, is to be kata holy, according to the whole. We're open to everybody. We are universal. Which, of course, we have never been. Northern and Southern Ireland being a good example. Well, example after example. And the Coptic Church in Slovenia protested by picketing Francis's visit there to say Mass in the cathedral. So, it spreads all over, you know. This discriminatory tendency, this thirst for a super purity. There is no super purity, folks. And we didn't have to hear Donald Trump, his ersatz apology last night, say this. We are not pure. If we are not, as Francis constantly describes the church, a field hospital for everybody. Not a gathering of the elect and the super pure, but a hand held out to everyone. I don't know how deeply that sunk in the minds of a bunch of bishops. I'm sure it has not sunk it at all. In fact, they find it an affront and have publicly said so. A number of them did. Cardinal Chaput in Philadelphia. Cardinal Burke in the Vatican. Openly criticizing the Pope because he is too generous, too open to too many people. But I would like to finish with a question. If we are not Francis kind of Catholic, what kind of Catholics are we?